I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 floating up to the ceiling here in 2022. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phil Iskov.
And with us today is the co-creator of the upcoming Pretty Little Lies Original Sin. That's pretty cool. And my old friend, Lindsay. Lindsay, are you Lindsay Bring, Lindsay Calhoun Bring, or Lindsay Calhoun?
I'm Lindsay Calhoun Bring. I was once Lindsay Calhoun. I got married. I kept Calhoun as a middle name. Lindsay Bring, Lindsay Calhoun Bring.
Lindsay Calhoun Bring.
Yeah.
What are you going to be credited on? Credited as? Created by Lindsay Calhoun Bring?
Yeah. Yep.
And
Roberto.
And some other guy.
And some other Roberto Aguirre Sacasa guy. No one's heard of him.
Yeah, no one's heard of that guy.
No one's heard of it. But very exciting, Lindsay. I'll ask you questions about that tomorrow when we have breakfast.
Yeah. Great.
Because today we're here to talk about a movie that, well, look, a movie.
I mean, it's a movie.
It's been on the list since the beginning. Yeah. I thought it was just another movie that came out in 1999. Mm-hmm. I thought it was some, you know, failed star vehicle for Sarah Michelle Gellar, which it most certainly is. Don't get me wrong. commercially speaking, I thought it was just some little trifle that, you know, just kind of came and went. And I thought she was a cook, and it was like that. I thought it was like a teenish version of that Catherine Zeta-Jones movie, No Reservations.
Sure.
A couple of people just fall in love and eat some food. This movie is not that. Mm-mm. This is one of the weirdest movies we've ever done. And look, is it a great movie? No. Is it a bad movie? Yes. Is it a delightful movie? Absolutely.
100%.
One of the most delightful movies you'll ever see. Simply irresistible. Lives up to its title. Phil, what do you think of this movie?
I mean, listen, I think that this movie is incompetent, but I think
I don't know if that's what I would call it.
I think this movie is how can I put this? Kenny and I were texting a little bit as he was watching this film, and he sent me a picture of himself when he pressed play on this film for the first, like, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes of this movie. I think I had a similar face too. Of
your
like
your face never changed. My face did. That's what I would say.
Sure. I think that your reaction was similar to my reaction, which is when you hit play on this film, you're sort of.
This was my play face.
This was his initial face.
It's pretty good.
Perplexed.
This is my face at the end of the movie.
Sure.
Mind blown. Yeah.
I mean, I guess the thing here, and Kenny and I sort of texted a little bit around this idea, and obviously, Lindsay, we can't wait to hear what you have to say about this.
So I can't wait to hear.
So forgive me. I'll just say that I think it's... I'm kind of a little surprised that this film doesn't have more of a I hate the term cult following, because like that is such a whatever. But like Kenny referred to The Room at one point in his texts.
In the beginning, not to cut you off, Phil.
Yeah.
In the beginning, I thought it was like The Room because I thought it was like you said, because I really did change over the course of this film.
I know you did, yeah.
In the beginning, I thought it was utterly incompetent. Like I really did. I thought it was an incompetent film in the beginning, and like on the level of on par with The Room. But I love The Room. I genuinely, you know, like in my heart, like love The Room, and think like to make something that singular in and of itself is a triumph. As the movie went on and crazier shit happened that was not, you know, let's have a football catch mark, but more like we're going to give you apples that when you cut into them explode with, you know, like pheromones. There were decisions that were made in this movie. This was not like the product of like, we don't know what we're doing, so let's like do what a movie maker might do, which is why I love The Room so much. The Room feels like a poorly programmed cyborg was tasked with making a movie.
That's correct.
Where's this? And still is walking around to this day. But this actually feels like, and I mean, I don't mean to start at such an extremity, Phil, because I don't know if I really believe this, but like, the movie that it felt like to me at the end was this came together. I mean, they came together, which was like, I think they're spoofing rom-coms. This is so fucking crazy. Now, I don't mean spoofing, but you know, it's like, it's, and I mean that like when you are spoofing or satirizing or doing a parody of, is it necessary for you to be like, this is a parody? Or can you have crazy fucking ass hilarious shit happen and have the viewer at the end be like, this couldn't be real, like this, but it is, like as I said to Phil, like any movie where the grand romantic gesture is a perfectly thrown paper airplane from a third story window into a moving cab, they can't have been serious with this. Okay, Lindsay, what do you think of this film?
That's a very interesting perspective, and one now that I'm coming around to. There was, so when I, Kenny, we talked about doing this podcast for a while, and I'm so excited to be on it. I'm a big fan. I've been listening to the episodes.
Thank you.
I love you guys. I love the podcast, and I was so excited. And 1999, obviously the best year in the world for movies. And we talked about so many. And by the time we got to me, we were in the dregs, guys. We just were. And I was like, I remember seeing Simply Irresistible in the movie theater. I went to see it, and I went for Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Sure.
Because I loved her and
who doesn't
love her, and was watching Buffy at the time, and like whatever she starred in, I would go to. And so I thought, okay, we'll do this. I was not expecting last night. I think I blocked out so much of it. I remembered the magical crab. I remembered that she was a chef. And I that was it. I barely remembered Sean Patrick Flannery. I, of course, had no context for Patricia Clarkson when I was 13. No, or
Dylan Baker.
Dylan Baker, right? Yeah, sure. Who Patricia Clarkson wants, you know, his hands all over her, as we all do.
Oh, it's wild.
Who doesn't? Yeah, sure.
I texted Kenny as well, and I said, I'm seconds into this, and this is insane. And it was, we hadn't hit the minute mark. It was so crazy. The walk through the farmer's market, the magical man who was VFX poorly into every shot outside. Yes. I just, buckled in and was kind of on the trip of a lifetime. The thing that you just said, Phil, about a cult following, the thing that the movie that popped into my head was Teen Witch, also sort of a magical
movie. Teen Witch.
Sure. I love Teen Witch. Yes. I don't know if you've seen it recently. It makes no sense. Watch it today. I don't know where anybody came from, what they're doing, why it's happening. It's no sense. The friend who's so amazing disappears in like the last third of the movie. I don't know why she likes this guy, but it had a cult following because it was stylish and it was magical. And Robin Tunney was so winning and amazing. And I feel
Robin
like
Lively.
Robin Lively. Oh my God. Thank you.
Robin Tunney Lively. Also great.
Robin sure. Tunney is sure. just yeah. as stunning and winning and amazing. And magical. But I think they kind of pushed the style in a way that Simply Irresistible mm-hmm. didn't. Like, I think you're right, Kenny, listening to you. I think they were making fun of rom-coms, but they played it straight.
I that's what I'm trying to like wrap my head around, because like there's just like too much. It's all like 10% too far. Like the scene that I referenced in the beginning with the floating up to the ceiling.
Yeah.
First of all, no one's seen this movie. So we should give like our little context to what it is. But there's a scene in the middle of this film where Sarah Michelle Gellar and Sean Patrick Flannery are. And I have to explain how this is even plausible in the film. But basically, like, Sarah Michelle Gellar is able to like cook her feelings into food. And
which I love.
If she feels love for someone, they literally are kissing and floating to the ceiling. And like at some point it stops being like this, you know, it stops being like the La La Land thing where they're floating in the Griffin Observatory, which I thought was beyond fucking words.
Sure.
Stupid.
It's beautiful. Magical.
Awful. And becomes this thing where Sean Patrick Flannery becomes aware of it. And he's like, wait a second, get me down here. And he's kind of stuck to the ceiling. Yeah. And I guffawed and I'm like, there's something else here. You know, there's just something else going on here than just like, let's throw it all against the screen and see what sticks.
I'm going to give context, but I do just want to say that I don't disagree with what you guys are saying. The difference is that I didn't find it charming because it didn't work. There's an aspiration of what they're trying to do here. It just didn't work for me. I'm not disputing the fact that there are intelligent people behind this film with goals and perhaps intent.
We're way too early for this part of the conversation.
But I don't. The synopsis of this film, after her mother's death, mediocre chef Amanda Shelton, played by Sarah Michelle Gellar, is having trouble attracting customers to her family's restaurant. While shopping for ingredients, she's given a magical crab by mysterious Gene O'Reilly. Afterward, Amanda's dishes suddenly become excellent, inducing some strong emotional reactions in everyone who eats them. Tom Bartlett, played by Sean Patrick Flannery, who is preparing to open his own eatery, tries her cooking and falls in love. Simply Irresistible opened on February 5th, 1999, against Payback, She's All That, Patch Adams, Varsity Blues, and in its 30th week of release, Saving Private Ryan. It would go on to make $4.4 million on a $6 million budget. It's got 16% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 54% from audiences. Now, Roger Ebert gives the film 3 stars says
the weirdest thing I've ever heard.
Which is bizarre. And his take, I don't really agree with, but we can unpack that. Simply Irresistible is old-fashioned and obvious. Yes, like a featherweight comedy from the 50s, but that's the charm. I love movies that cut loose from the moorings of the possible and dance among their fancies. When Woody Allen waltzed with Goldie Hawn in the banks of the Seine and Everyone Says I Love You, and she floated in the air and just stayed up there, my heart danced too. And the closing scenes of Simply Irresistible are like that. It's not a great movie, but it's a charmer.
He just liked it.
So I need to say this because I do feel like this is a bee in my bonnet and something that doesn't bother Kenny and perhaps doesn't bother you, Lindsay. But like the filmmaking incompetence that I mentioned earlier is very hard for me to see past. The performances are incredibly stilted. The script is nonsensical. It's doesn't have a big budget, but we have watched movies, Kenny, with lower budgets than this that have looked infinitely better than this film.
Movie looks genuinely awful.
It is hot garbage. So it's one of those things where that's a hurdle for me. But anyway.
Well, that's the artifice is what I like. Now I can't, like, I mean, as I said to you and I said to both of you over text, like, yeah. This guy had come off doing, well, he didn't come off. He was produced. In the middle of producing three John Waters movies. He did Serial Mom, Pecker, and Cecil B. Demented, which comes out the year later.
Mm-hmm. Wacky movies.
Wacky movies. That are, that where the artifice is on display, right? There's something about that awful fucking looking restaurant, Southern Cross. That like isn't awful in a John Waters way. It's not awful in that, like, I mean, I would like I would get fucking, you know, tuberculosis from walking into most John Waters restaurants. But it is like no one would want to go there. Now the thing about the Southern Cross is no one wants to go there. Like the food sucks. Yeah. And then there's a scene early on in there where Amanda Peet just loses her mind and starts throwing plates. It's
bonkers.
Fantastic. Like it's like in the moment it's weird, but in the context of the film, it's just like fantastic. I know I sound crazy. This is one of those movies where I'm like, I mean, though it kind of is like Dudley Do Right, where I would be like, no, this is actually great.
I mean, Dudley Do Right is a masterpiece, though. I mean, yeah, we both agree that
Dudley Do Right is like, you guys, no one gave this a chance. Like, no one even acknowledged this movie's existence. Correct. And like, that's actually a great film. This is like genuinely pushing the medium at times.
Yes.
I couldn't believe what I was watching. And I think that's why I liked it. I don't know. This to me was the definition of a movie that would not get made today.
Oh,
nobody would make, and I'm very charmed by movies of a certain time.
Or in 99.
This movie would not get made in 99. get made today.
I really do hear where you're coming from on the John Waters thing. It's not a coincidence, right? This guy producing John Waters films and then making this film, there's a corollary there. Now, of course, the difference is that this filmmaker, whose name I don't know off the top of my head, can't
I'll find it for you.
Sure. Can't juggle the tone and isn't locked in to what John Waters does, for instance, right? Like he's trying to do too many things. And I would also argue that like the casting is also bonkers. Patricia Clarkson Dylan Baker do feel like they know what movie they're in. I would argue Sarah Michelle Gellar does not.
It seemed like they thought they were in a grounded romantic comedy.
Right.
And it's very much not that. They're literally lifting off the floor.
That's kind of what a movie I started looking up and just trying to like get my head around watching this movie was Starship Troopers.
Oh, I love Starship Troopers.
Starship Troopers is great. Sure.
But Starship Troopers, of course, is a masterpiece. But, you know, part of the I don't want to say the joke, but part of the
I mean, it's a parody of
yeah. Oh, well, yeah. I mean, part of the shtick of Starship Troopers had, you know, a similar trajectory to this in that everyone took it seriously until a point. Right? The point with Simply Irresistible is this podcast, but with Starship Troopers, it was, you know, maybe like a year or two later, people started being like, wait a second, this might not have been as serious as it seemed. What I wanted to say about Starship Troopers is, though, that the stars, all these gorgeous stars, were never told what they were doing. They were told they were in a fucking, you know,
correct.
A space epic, a sci-fi epic. And they took it, you know, deadly as seriously as they can. Now, I don't mean to like denigrate Sarah Michelle Gellar, who has already won a podcast like It's 1999 award for me for her perfect role in Cruel Intentions, one of my favorite actresses who's ever lived.
Agree, same.
But I do think, truly, one of my favorite actresses who's ever lived, and my first crush. Like, I would risk it all for Sarah Michelle Gellar. But I do think this, to some respect, she was just cast because she's a pretty face. And she's a good actress who would take this material seriously. The reason I bring up The Room and the reason I bring up Starship Troopers is like, I think the filmmakers were doing something differently than everybody else. And I think there is a slyness to this movie that even, you know, even escapes the actors in it. I don't mind that they don't know what movie they're in. Like, that's what I'm getting at. I don't mind. Like,
You bring up the casting, and it's worth noting who was originally cast in this film and who they originally chased to cast in this film. Holly Hunter was their first choice for the role. And then they chased Sarah Jessica Parker.
I see that.
They wanted an older person who was sort of at a certain point in their life. And I guess the studio pushed for Sarah Michelle Gellar because she was young and she was popping off of Buffy and what have you. The Holly Hunter version of this film, I mean, I don't even know what that is. I say that with obviously nothing but love for Holly Hunter. There is a sincerity to this movie that belies the slyness that I feel Kenny is perhaps referring to. And that, please, Lindsay, go ahead.
No. Sorry to interrupt. So many things. One, Kenny, obviously I love you invoking Cruel Intentions. It must be said that Cruel Intentions was released exactly 1 month after this movie. And I wonder if Sarah's reps were part of that. It's like, yes. Pull this up. Yeah. I actually think that Sarah and Sean knew exactly what movie they were in. And that's the performance that you got. I think that they were like, we know what this movie is. We know what we're doing. We are cashing this paycheck and we are doing this movie and we're going through it. But I will say, I think they were here. There were some scenes where I was like, this is flat. There were some scenes I thought they were here for it.
He definitely was.
He was here for
it. He knew what he was doing. Yeah, Lindsay, this movie has in every fucking scene a crab puppet.
Crab puppet
who doesn't do anything except move his eyes. And occasionally, like, you know, feel up a guy's leg.
Yeah,
it has a crab puppet. Okay, we should describe this movie a little bit. Because I'm going to tell you what I thought. I think I did say what I thought this movie was. I thought this was about a lovely chef who was a little daffy, who couldn't pull her shit together. A nice girl playing, I think, not that Buffy wasn't nice, but kind of an innocent, right? Yeah. I thought she was playing a little against type. You know, you have in Cruel Intentions, she's playing Buffy turned bad to some extent. Obviously, Buffy's kick-ass heroine, who's, you know, heart of gold. I thought she was an innocent. I thought she was kind of taken along the ride in this movie. I thought she found love through a shared love of cooking. And I thought it was a very boring late 90s rom-com about people in their early 20s. This is what this movie is. I will do my best to explain it to you, audience members. This movie is about, and Phil said some of it in his Google,
I mean, that is what the movie's about, but sure. Feel free to dive deeper.
Top that.
I will do my best. Reference. No, you are. So you and I want to come back to the Teen Witch of it all, which I thought was very astute, Lindsay. This movie's about, as Phil said, a chef, a mediocre chef, if that, a bad chef whose mother owned a restaurant called the Southern Cross, which I guess was fairly good and now totally sucks, who is given a magical crab by a random guy dressed like Colonel Tom Parker.
Yeah.
Yes.
Who shows up randomly at a farmer's market where she knows everybody there. She's basically told her own restaurant is closing there, but she didn't know that. She buys only raspberries at this farmer's market and the crab, which she doesn't know how to make.
Wonder why her restaurant went under.
That's part of the joke of this. Is like she clearly is a shitty chef. Like a shitty chef.
That's me at a grocery store, by the way. It's like, oh, I need to go pick up, like, I'm going to make, like, French chicken tonight, but I should just get chocolate pudding cups because that's what I eat at home. Like, I don't need to go and buy a whole chicken. I'm going to sit in the fridge. It's going to go to I just need to buy raspberries and pudding.
I know. I, like, got home from dropping my kid off at school at 9. I'm like, ooh, 9, podcast at 10. I have an hour. I'm going to make myself an omelet. I had a granola bar.
An omelet? I had an Eggo waffle.
So She buys this stuff. Sean Patrick Flannery is then, he's dating Amanda Peet, who Patricia Clarkson, who I guess is his assistant or friend or
enter 90s ultimate trope of the female executive assistant who's very invested in the male boss.
Yes, that's what that is. His hot assistant because she's very hot,
beautiful,
stunning.
And who's very hot and very thin, who makes a point of saying that Amanda Peet is like
she's a
stick or something. She's like, I tried to get her a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Okay. He's dating Amanda Peet. They're on the third date. They act as if they've been together for 100 years and hate each other already. Sean Patrick Flannery has a PowerPoint presentation to show how after his third dates, it always goes terribly. It's bizarre. I agree, Phil. The filmmaking is just terrible. Sean Patrick Flannery is taken by Gene O'Reilly, the man who looks like Tom Parker, to this restaurant randomly. He goes in, he eats there. The food is incredible because she's already has the magical crab who makes your food incredible. This is real.
This is crabatouille. Crabatouille.
He just kind of stands there and looks at his crab eyes. But I think the food makes you be really honest, right? That's the idea.
It's muddy.
It makes you feel feelings really loudly and audibly.
It makes you feel her feelings.
Yes, that makes sense. That's clear.
It makes you feel Sarah Michelle Gellar's feelings.
But why does Amanda Peet then get really mad about life and starts throwing plates around, like in a very dangerous way, in a small restaurant, like?
That was an act of domestic terrorism.
Because part of me in the beginning was like, why cast Amanda Peet, a very strong comic actress, in this thankless role? And then you're like, oh, of course, because she has this incredible set piece where she goes ham on a restaurant, like throwing these plates at people. Then I checked out for about an hour and a half. And then, through like a set of more random circumstances, like she gets the job working at Sean Patrick Flannery's 4-star restaurant in the middle of Henri Bendel, which is a department store. And they,
because that's where all the great restaurants are in the middle.
Well, I will acknowledge they had a news report early in the film saying you're trying something new here, a 4-star restaurant in the middle of a department store. He's like, I think it's the future of dining. And he's like some sort of, you know, genius diner person. And then like she cooks some more food for people. They feel some more feelings. Patricia Clarkson is dying to fuck her boss, Dylan Baker. They eventually do in an elevator after eating.
Because she gives them eclairs at first.
That's how I work. Yeah.
After eating the incredible eclairs that Sarah Michelle Gellar cooks, she takes over the restaurant. They have some wild fucking ass opening for it. And like literally this is when the movie goes from like, is it good to is it great.
Amazing. Yeah.
He cooks this food for every New York high society who are coming to the opening of this restaurant, and they all start weeping.
Yeah.
Everybody in the restaurant starts weeping at this food. A man who I can only assume is the poet laureate of New York City stands up and starts reading a poem, some of which I took down because it was so good.
Good.
The food is the perfect poem. This food is the perfect poem I've never wrote. It's happiness that only comes to you in dreams. I mean, like,
yeah, guys, as writers, I just think that we should appreciate the artist's
beautiful words. And then
the whole room fills up with this smoky, you know, hazy serum of love. Everybody
obsessed with atmosphere.
Dances like it's out of like Busby Berkeley's worst film. It's all black and white behind them. Like, it's just, it's so weird and bad and wonderful and silly and goofy. And then Sarah Michelle Gellar runs off. I don't really know why. She gets in a cab to leave forever. Sean Patrick Flannery, who has an obsession with throwing the world's longest paper airplane. Like, his thing is like Howard Hughes once threw in a paper airplane for 4 miles. I'm going to beat it. He has a paper airplane sculpture in his office. He pulls one off. He throws it. This movie's amazing. He throws it perfectly. It lands in her cab on her lap. He sticks the landing. They fall in love and then they eat the crab. I don't know what happens at the end. I got lost. But that's kind of this movie. Lindsay, do you have anything you want to add?
Yeah, no, there are a few things to unpack here. Well, you sort of grazed it earlier, but I want to unpack a scene later in the movie that I think is the most horrible scene in the film, and yet the best and the strangest and the oddest shot. After Sarah Michelle Gellar has successfully saved the day with the opening of this 4-star restaurant in this department store, you know, she has an adversary in this movie, not just Amanda Peet, who we do away with in the plate throwing early on, which I thought about that scene. I think I understand that scene a little bit, but she has a very,
I think I understand it, guys.
She has a very mean French sous chef in the kitchen
who only shows up halfway through the third act.
He's the big bad of the movie. And she's got to prove him wrong. And, you know, she wins him over. And by the end of the movie, the food is so good. He cracks open what I believe is a peach filled with white goo. His eyes go crossed. He dips a finger in it, feeds it to the crab. Mm-hmm. That is the most Call Me By Your Name fucked up shit I have ever seen. Why are we cracking into the jizz beach? Why do we have
so
a close up?
Good. This is like, as I said this to both of you, because this was like, all right, so a couple things. I mean, so there's the jizz peach, which I thought was great. There's also the scene where there's a little tiny runner that the actual chef, who's like the most amazing chef in the world, like, I can't believe you got, you know, Jean-Pierre Francais to do your restaurant. And he's really upset with the quality of the knives, which is all to set up a scene where he just starts throwing knives at people to show how he wants to quit. And he quits, you know. So the sous chef Lindsay alluded to is his sous chef, who shows up and she's like, usually Jean-Pierre gives me instructions and I just follow them. So what am I talking? She's like, I don't actually cook. The crab does the work. Larry Gillard Jr. hangs out, like, basically just to tell her about, like, you know, things men do with their boners. So there's also a runner about every time a man adjusts his belt, that means he is aroused, which, you know, as a man, not true.
I had questions about that, because there's a whole runner of like, oh, let's do the math. Well, one, two things. Sorry to interrupt you, Kenny.
But so weird.
There were two things. One, the paper airplane runner, right? And there's this great line where Sarah Michelle Gellar knows about paper airplanes, and Sean Patrick Flannery's like, how do you know so much about planes? And she's like, I was bad at algebra. I don't know how that math adds up.
So
crazy.
This is what I said. Because at one point, I really did think this was going to be the worst movie we did. Like, there was a moment where I'm like, oh, this is the worst movie we're going to do the whole time. And I said, but I now think this is a compliment. Yeah. What I'm going to read you. This is the weirdest and worst film we've done. It's like it's written by a few precocious 10th graders put together as a team to do a class project, collaborate on a romantic comedy. One heard the fact about men and sex, how they, you know, think of sex every 6 minutes or whatever it was. Another loves fairy tales with magical animals. And a third has a weird Howard Hughes predilection. And they just, it's like you put together three or four really weird 10th graders. And it was the situation where, like, everyone was too polite to be like, that doesn't work. Let's not do that. Everyone was just like, yeah, put it in. But in real life, and this is what I actually like, this is when this movie started to really become kind of exciting and transcendent to me, was in real life, this is a collaboration between a husband and a wife team.
I love
that.
The
fact that these two people who are married were like, this is where their Venn diagram meets. This is the kind of stuff that gets them going. As I said to both of you, these two must be such a great hang. Could you imagine going to their house? Such a great hang, these weirdos. So, I truly am tickled by this.
So,
Lindsay, you are also someone who collaborates with your husband on some weird ass shit.
Yeah, we love to collaborate on weird ass shit. I'm charmed by it. I'm here for it. I don't know. It's like, I don't know that we could ever achieve. I feel jealous that John and I have never thought of anything as wackadoo as this.
What is your comic series called?
Oh God, Penguins versus Possums.
Yeah, and Penguins versus Possums doesn't hold a candle to this. That was wackadoo.
Phil, I feel like you were about to jump in on our love fest of Simply.
I really don't want to be a wet blanket. Like, I don't want to be the person that says, like, you know, I don't agree with what you guys are saying. Cause like, that's not, there's no fun in that. And it's not to say that what you guys are saying is falling on deaf ears. It's certainly not. I think that part of my frustrations with this movie, and it's sort of why I don't like The Room either. We've talked a lot on this podcast about intent, right? Which is when a filmmaker sits down and intends to make a thing. And I completely understand, and I have no problem necessarily with somebody watching a film that intended to do one thing, but getting enjoyment out of its complete failure of doing that, or enjoying the film on a different level.
That is not the way we talk about it.
I'm not. Let me finish what I'm saying. Okay. I think that it's this film to me is, having read these, and I will read these quotes from the director, Mark Tarlov, and his wife, Judith Roberts, and talking about what they were perhaps intending to do with this film. And I think that if they were successful in doing those things for you guys, more power to them. That's completely fine. I don't think they were successful in achieving those things. And I understand the enjoyment that you get from a film that is, and again, I don't mean, I'm certainly not attacking either of you. I think that the enjoyment of a film that is so crazy and so all over the place and so kind of wildly insane is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. I just didn't log into that with this particular film.
All right. Before we go further, that is not how we talk about intent on this podcast. Or maybe it is. If you want to talk about it that way, you can. But the way we talk about intent on this podcast generally is we assume intent. If something makes you feel a certain way, we give the director, give the writer, give the people who are involved with the film the benefit of the doubt that they at least had more of an understanding of their piece of work than we do. So I don't, as I said to you, and I don't mean to, like, I know you didn't take it very nicely when I said it on our text, but what a boring way to watch a film to look at quotes the people said and say, well, does this film line up with the quotes? Who cares? Like, I see something there that I think that I think implies or denotes that there's more going into this film than what those quotes, you know, those two quotes on a Wikipedia page may portend, or really what any reviewer, what anyone's, you know, kind of feelings of it. The idea is the film is the thing. The content is the thing. What some director or some producer says about it and says what they might have been trying to do is honestly totally fucking irrelevant to my enjoyment of the film.
Well, but okay. And listen, you're entitled to that opinion. Obviously, I hope
everybody who watches your films feel the same way that I do, because it's not fair to watch something someone does. I hope when people watch Pretty Little Liars Original Sin, they don't start pulling up Lindsay's interviews and being like, well, you know, look, I mean, she wanted to do this thing and she's not. It's all about the thing.
But Kenny, I just hope they watch it.
I'll be there day one.
Kenny, you're being, I mean, listen, I understand what you're saying, but it's also this idea that we subscribe to the idea that a filmmaker has intent. Sure. Then the filmmaker says that intent, but we don't agree with that intent. So we're going to project our own intent onto it. Seems a little bit ridiculous.
Filmmaker says that intent. Read the quotes. We can.
No filmmaker can tell you
in two sentences what they meant to do with the film. You're a writer. You know this.
Kenny, I love that you're going to the mat for this movie. I love that this movie spoke to you, and that's fine. And I don't have a problem with that. But listen, I watched this movie. I didn't enjoy this film. I did the did the research into trying to figure out what the fuck these filmmakers were trying to do. You didn't. That's fine.
Oh no, but I read it. I just don't think
listen to what I'm saying. Okay.
You just said I didn't. I'm telling you, I did. Kenny, go ahead.
I just don't think. Listen, personally speaking, I think it's great that this movie worked for you guys. I really do. I'm not sitting here saying that you shouldn't enjoy the film. I'm saying I didn't. And one of the reasons that I didn't is because I don't feel as though there is this Machiavellian plan that these two people had in terms of like, it's just not there for me. I think the end of this film is charming. I think that that whole sequence with them eating the stuff is charming. I don't think there's anything wrong with that stuff. I don't think, however, it makes up for the fact that the preceding fucking 70 minutes are absolute fucking garbage nonsense.
This is totally fair. This is a different discussion, though.
But, well, okay, Lindsay, please.
I have a question, because this is something we talked about earlier. How do we know how long it took to make this movie or what the budget was?
We don't. And, the budget of the film was I believe I the budget was $6 million. It made 4.4. I'm not trying to sit here and say that there was no intellectual aspirations for this movie. I'm just thinking that they failed at doing that.
Oh, I hear that. I think it's so funny because when you watch it at the time, and if you transport yourself to 99 and think about seeing it as I did,
I think
it was plated and served to you as a rom-com in the same way that You've Got Mail is, in which case comparatively is terrible.
Yes. Like
if you put it up against the movies of the time that were served to you as a rom-com, terrible. And I think I even thought at the time, like, oof, man. And then when Cruel Intentions came out, it was like, oh, thank God. Everyone's forgotten about Simply Irresistible and Sarah's going to be okay. I just want Sarah to be okay. Though I do think she did hold her own in this and was quite charming. Watching it today, weirdly, I guess, and thinking about what you said, Kenny, and knowing now that the pair who made this movie are a married couple, which does sort of change things to me as well, of kind of like, what could we do together that's just fucking fun? Let's make a movie. Let's do it the way we want to. And also not discounting the fact that a woman did write this rom-com. And even though there are a lot of 90s tropes there, they do sort of have a feminine touch. Even Patricia Clarkson, it's like she's not in love with her boss. She's not in love with Sean Patrick Flannery. Mm-hmm. She wants to fuck someone else, and I want your help to do it. Like, I've got my own thing. I don't care about who you're dealing with. There's something about it that makes me think, ooh, are you touching on something, Kenny? Were they poking at rom-coms? Was the woman who wrote this, was she talking with her husband and was like, women are always fucking cooking. There's always the scene where like the restaurant is closed the fuck down and she makes him something delicious and he wants to fuck her because he's never had an eclair so good. Like the woman's always magical. There's always like the woman makes him feel like he's never felt before. He makes him feel like a child again. Like he doesn't have to be a grumpy old business person. He's whimsical. Like, okay, what else is fucking crazy? Like, is there maybe the food is the thing that's cooking for? I feel like there's something so tropey about it. It checks off all the 90s rom-com tropes that maybe they had to be with it. And it was just ahead of its time.
Now that we're going to talk about quotes and intent, I'll throw a quote to you. Mark Tarlov did an extended interview about this movie. Oh. With Blake J. Harris, who I happened to go to high school with. So there you go. Blake J. Harris. So this was for How Did This Get Made, which this movie was featured on How Did This Get Made, appropriately so. And sometimes they would do interviews after. So basically what he's trying to say is that, and I think this is evident in this film, and this is why I say he is pushing the medium. He brings up this idea of theory of relativity and Einstein's theory of relativity. And the idea is, if you have your hand on a stone, on a stove, it feels like an hour, right? If you have your hand on a stove for a second, it feels like an hour. Time is relative based on the experience you're feeling, right? So everything is relative. And when you're watching a film, nothing has to be the way it is. So many of the movies we love so much don't come out and tell you we are now in a magical realm. A movie that, for whatever reason, jumps to my head when I watch this movie is Eraserhead. Because, because the dinner scene in Eraserhead with the chicken and all that shit reminds me in a weird way of what's happening in this film, where no one in that movie is ever saying this isn't reality. It is all kind of, you know, within the guise of course it's not reality. It's a fucking movie. We do whatever we want. You know, that's all of Lynch to me.
Sure.
You know, it's a movie. We do whatever we want. I make the rules, right? Okay. So the crab Blake asks about the crab.
Yeah.
The crab idea is very much this notion of, guys, this is not possible. It's not real magic. It was really supposed to be the conduit for this notion of an American kind of magical realism, right? This is not really happening, what we're showing you. Like, people floating in the ceiling, they're not literally floating in the ceiling. And I thought, well, let's just take an element of this. And nobody, by the way, ever said to me, don't crabs live in water? Like, can a crab live on a shelf? Because I would have said to them, well, no, that is the point. We shot a whole stuff about the crab, the life of the crab. It was the way we were going to get an intellectual conceit of a magical American magical realism. The crab was really a conduit for that piece of storytelling. It was intellectually, maybe, as my partner said, a little too ambitious. But you know, when it comes to things like that, I believe in the opposite of P.T. Barnum. I think people are a lot smarter than they let on. And Blake says, as a viewer, I appreciate that. So the crab was the embodiment of the whole idea of Einsteinian theory of relativity and the fact that pheromones can change time and space, you know, the whole idea, you know, in a popular song about time standing still when you see the right person or floating or whatever. It was all the embodiment in that crab, but very obviously artfully done better in the director's cut. All right. I will stop it right there.
That's all fine and good. I appreciate all of the things that he, do you think he was successful in doing this? Like, do you think that he conveyed?
Oh, yeah, totally. But I don't think that's. I want to make this clear.
Okay.
I think all he was trying to do mm-hmm. was make the attempt. So by making the attempt, by even attempting to do these things with the crab and the floating and the magical realism without ever calling magical realism, simply putting these stuff on the stuff on the screen, that's a success, right? That is pushing the bounds, that is taking the audience and taking them out of their comfort zone and what they have come to expect from a romantic comedy or an American movie in 1999. Was he successful? Like, I don't even know. Like, is David Lynch successful with the baby who looks like an alien? Well, I mean, of course, I think the answer is yes. God forbid I should say anything blasphemous about David Lynch, but like, it's only success. It's the by simply putting it on the screen, you start to get taken out of your comfort zone, start to ask questions of why is this here? What is happening? What is this representing? How did this even make it here?
I do have questions.
Then you're playing ball with the movie a little bit. So if you're willing to play ball with this idea of like, all right, this fucking crab is really fucking crazy. What is going on? That quote to me at least answers the question of it's more than just let's throw a silly animal in there. Like there were thoughts behind it. So maybe it wasn't successful in your opinion, but at least you can engage with it the way that he intended at this point. This is, I know, this is crazy.
I love
saying crazy shit.
I wish I could get on this ride with you guys. I really do. And I don't say that in a patronizing way. I wish I agreed. I do. I think this movie, despite the fact that it's making valiant attempts at stuff, is just to speak of it in the same sentence with David Lynch is something. I think David Lynch would appreciate it.
I think he would appreciate it the goal of making the movie is creating your own world. And like, not even the goal, though, the reality of making a movie is creating your own world. And any attempt that deviates from tropes and typical structure in and of itself is a bit of a victory. That's kind of why I like The Room, you know?
Lindsay? It feels like a victory this got made. Of course this was on How Did This Get Made. I'm going to listen to that immediately.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do have questions. I do have questions. Now that you bring up questions, kidding. One, who is Gene O'Reilly? Is Gene the man doing the magic, or is the crab doing the magic? I'm not sure. I'd have to say one thing too. I didn't think I would ever feel any tension in the movie. The only time I felt tense in the movie was when the crab was in a scene with the mean chef before the ending. And I was like, he's gonna kill the fucking crab. He's gonna feed the crab. And I felt tense and I wasn't expecting that. So I'm glad he's okay. I'm invested.
John Waters would have had him cook the crab.
100%.
Totally. And that's interesting in its own right.
Totally. I'm like, the crab lived is crazy. And then the other question is, sorry, I have actually.
No, please. Yeah.
So the crab living is crazy. I was like, the crab deserves death. And then the other question is, so is she, in your sort of, you know, magical realism, is the crab even there? Like, maybe this is all real. In a version where this is real, this is magic, the crab is magic, the crab is responsible for all good things, what happens to Sarah Michelle Gellar and Sean Patrick Flannery's love when that, how long do crabs live? What happens when the crab goes away? What happens when he finds out this bitch can't really cook?
Like, that's a really great and totally irrelevant question.
What happens? Because
the answer is nothing.
Nothing. Because I thought, like, oh, the other thing is throughout the movie, it's like, the other thing is like, oh no, Sarah Michelle Gellar, like, her best friend in the restaurant's like, you're talented. The reason you can cook is not earrings. It's because you're really good at this. And she's like, I'm definitely not.
No, I fucking love this movie, actually. The fact that she had some stupid ass fucking answer for why she became a good cook, which was she's wearing her mom's earrings.
My dead mom's earrings.
It was actually magical crab, is so funny and good and weird. So the answer to your like really interesting but totally relevant question is nothing happens to them after them because they don't exist after this because they don't exist. Period. They're like, when the movie ends, these characters die.
But I want, they're not to real. Know. I want to believe they live
but,
on.
But that's what I mean. That's why I love the artifice of this movie. It really is calling.
I'm heading towards Phil's part of the Kinsey scale of simply irresistible. Now,
yeah. No.
I guess as I watched the end of the movie, I was like, are we going to get to a place where Sarah Michelle Gellar learned enough? Sarah Michelle Gellar is the chef. Like, she does have talent. She can do this. And the truth is, she brings nothing to the table.
I like it.
She is beautiful. And I do think Sarah Michelle Gellar is winning. And I think she showed up to work in the movie. She gave us tears. She gave us emotion. She gave us whatever she could.
Sometimes.
And I'm obsessed with her. I'm obsessed. I just love her. But the one thing she didn't give us as a chef was the ability to chop a vegetable or cook. And then we find out that it's the crab the whole time, and it continues to be the crab. And the only reason Sean Patrick Flannery's in love with her is because she makes great eclairs. So I'm just really, I feel the same tension I felt when I thought the crab was going to die. I feel like he's going to ask her to like make him breakfast at home, and the crab's not going to be there, and she's not going to make him a good meal, and he's going to leave her. What does that say about me?
Well, he's definitely going to leave her because this guy is clearly, like, he goes on 3 dates and then he dumps people.
So he has a whole presentation about it.
Yeah, none of it really matters. It's a silly movie that exists in a silly movie world.
I feel stressed,
but that's what I love about it. Now that I'm more taken with every aspect of this movie than I was when I stopped when I finished watching it. It's extremely fucking weird, but also really fucking bold. I don't know how to say it. Like, these are some really bold ideas to put out in a studio movie starring Sarah Michelle Gellar.
I would love to be in the room in the 90s where you hear like, and it was all the crab. Like, I would love that.
My other point where you're saying was, it, what is the crab real? Is the crab, are they really flawed? Like, I'm again, because I'm only, you know, comparing this to the greatest movies ever made. Right. I'm brought to Magnolia, which was, you know, kind of like my baptism moment for movies. Like, the moment where I'm like, oh, I get it. Right. But it did happen when it's raining frogs, but it did happen was the moment that I'm like, oh, I get it now. Like, if it's in a movie, it happens. Stop letting your stupid brain get in the way. Like, this isn't real. This is a movie. It doesn't have to make sense in our terrestrial understanding of reality. There are different planes of existence, and this is one of them. And so, like, is the crab real? Yeah, the crab's real because it's in this fucking movie. Did they float? Yeah, they floated because it's in this fucking movie. It's all real in the way it's presented to you. It's like, this is a Magnolia, and I'm not trying to say it is, but that is the baptism of Magnolia. It is get out of your own fucking way and engage with what you're actually, you know, being given. Ooh. I can't believe this is happening.
I mean, I'm
asking you to get out of your own way and engage with what I'm giving you. You won't engage.
I know you think this is a failing on my part, and that's fine.
I didn't say that,
but
I think that you are. I think that you have your walls up, Phil.
I don't, Kenny. I watched this film. We've watched many movies together. Okay, almost 4 years of doing this, and periodically this happens where you connect with a thing that I don't connect with, and that's fine. And it's happened vice versa. This is just what it is, man. Like I appreciate your passion for this movie. I know you think I'm being patronizing. I'm not.
Only time I think you're being patronizing is when you say, you know, I know you think you're being patronizing. I don't think you're being patronizing. You're engaging.
I think that this movie is a symptom of a time when a movie like this could get made, where this guy produced a couple successful John Waters movies. He was able to get $6 million to make this rom-com that I'm sure was just a charge off in some way. And the studio was like, sure. They let him do it. And he never made another movie again for obvious reasons, because he doesn't, know how to make movies.
Too bold. And you know, his ideas are too big and bold.
It's because this movie's bad.
People don't know what to do with him. But
I love that you think he's an auteur, and that's great.
He is very clearly. This is just the fact that you don't like it is different. That's taste. He actually is an auteur. Like, this is
Kenny. Looking at Roger Ebert's review of this film, right?
Ebert misread it.
But Kenny, that's the only good review you can find is from someone who just kind of projected his own rom-com ideas onto it.
With all due respect, at the risk of being patronizing, it's not ever going to, convince me or compel me in an argument for you to say I'm the only one who feels this way. I don't give a shit.
I'm just telling you that, again, you can be you should love this movie. I don't care if you love this movie. I'm just saying that there are a lot of assumptions being made, in my opinion, as to why this film was made the way this film was made. That's all. And you're more than empowered to make those assumptions. And I'm more than empowered to say, I don't see those assumptions and this movie doesn't work for me.
You are certainly allowed to do that. What I'm saying to you is I think they're supported by the text.
I think that there is certainly, you said it best a couple minutes ago, which is if you're willing to get on what you believe is the wavelength of this movie, then it's going to support all the things that you're saying. And I'm just not getting on that wavelength with it.
You don't, of course. And you certainly don't have to get on any wavelengths that you don't want to get on. But I think that we've done so many movies here, and particularly on the Razzies draft as well. Like the one that this really does remind me of in terms of what I'm seeing versus what everyone else in the world is seeing is The Color of Night.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I also think is, you know, a bit of a masterpiece and a bit of a comment on the genre it's playing in without coming out and being like parody. And I think they're both kind of similarly brilliant, and they're both made by directors with really interesting filmographies who had never got a chance after, who I think tried something different And if you engage with both those films, are actually both this film and that film are both actually challenging, but people just didn't want to get on their wavelength. So, I think that there's something to this idea. I'm just going to say one more thing. I think there's something to this idea of the late in life auteur, which both of these guys are. I don't remember the guy who directed Color of Money, but you know, is it one of their film? It's a Color of Night. Color of Night, but his one other film was nominated for. He was nominated for Best Director and Best Screenplay. The Stuntman,
The Color Purple. The Color Purple. That was Steven Spielberg.
Very different film. Yeah.
Yes, I would take The Color of Night over it, but no knock on Color Purple. Good film.
Brilliant, by the way. One of my favorite movies.
Great film. You probably haven't seen Color of Night recently. Then
recently,
the thing with Color of Night, and the thing with Color of Night, and Simply Irresistible is, I think they are both the work of really frustrated men who have spent a lot of time in the movie industry trying to get their shit made, had really specific ideas of what a film could be in the genre, what works in the genre they play in, what doesn't work in the genre they play in, and they tried to get it across in a way that was easily misread. But that's why I like them so much. That's why I think they're so cool, is because you really have to give the movie your undying what's the word I'm looking for, every benefit of every doubt. I understand that. Like, you have to be like, this movie's worth my time, I will engage with it, you know, completely. And I think they are both very rewarding. I know that sounds crazy.
Well, no, I don't think it sounds crazy. And I just want to be very, very clear about something here, because
if you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You know, Kenny and I love a swing, right? We love someone attempting something, taking a swing and being bold and doing something potentially crazy, you know, filmically, artistically, whatever the case might be. I am 100% into that notion, right? I think that is absolutely the reason why we do what we do, right? Which is, as artists, we're trying to express ourselves. We have a thing we want to say, and sometimes we're lucky enough to get to say it. And I think that there is absolutely the intent of trying to do something with Simply Irresistible and with Color of Night. I just don't think they're successful in what they're attempting to do. Now, you can think they are, obviously. That's completely your prerogative, and that's your taste. And
wildly successful is what I would say.
Okay, fine.
So I think they could have been bolder in the filmmaking of this story.
This movie could have. I think that this movie just could have taken bigger swings in certain ways. Go ahead.
Oh, no, please, Phil.
I just to finish my thought, I'll just say this. I think that I understand why you love this movie and why you love Color of Night, Kenny. And obviously that's completely your choice. I think that had these films been more successful in what they were attempting to do, I would have been on board. I know that there is a challenging thing that can be interpreted as like, once I've risen to the challenge, this movie will break through and I will love this film. I just don't think that this or Color of Night falls into that category for me, but they do for you, and that's totally fine. But Lindsay, please, obviously, go.
Yeah, no, I hear you on, I guess what I mean too with going bigger and bolder and embracing what was on the page stylistically.
Right.
I forget who, maybe you, Kenny, brought up like the terrible looking restaurant, right? Like, even to unpack things like the production design in a movie like this, the department store should be whimsical as shit. The restaurant should be fucking beautiful and bright and colorful. And every single thing on the screen should be magical, I think, with what's on the page. But I do feel like some of the shots were sort of like, it was like watching Serendipity or watching like a movie that was set in New York or set in a department store without the element of a woman who's cooking with the aid of a magical crab. And even things like the costumes, right? Like as far as filmmaking, the things that always jump out at me are like, come on, guys. It's like Sarah Michelle Gellar has two shirts. She has this one gold tank top that she is in four different scenes on three different days in the movie with two different hairstyles. But she does have
that insane like jacket that looks like curtains that she wears to.
That's great.
That's great.
So, and that's like,
one nice outfit.
One sexy mid-length jacket, which I love. I love the friend like helping her pick out the outfit.
Yeah.
But I do think like even when we go into her bedroom, it's like the walls were beige. Like there are some things that aren't about budget or aren't about time. They are about taste. And I think like with what you have on the page, which is so crazy and so wacky, and you kind of just want the whole world to feel like fucking Willy Wonka's a little bit, just to kind of go into a nutso place.
This is where you and I diverge.
We can
this
diverge.
This is where you and I diverge.
We can come at me, bro.
This is our fork in the road. And it's not that like I disagree with you, but like. And this is like, again, a kind of crazy thing to say, but like, I think this movie is so in control of what it's doing that every decision was a decision. And it wasn't just like, you know, let's use the set that's here, or let's use the cheap set, or we can't think of anything good for Sarah Michelle Gellar, so let's use beige walls. I feel the same way I felt about Color of Money, which Color of Money looks pretty fucking ugly.
Color of Night.
Color of Night.
Purple, the color purple, Steven Spielberg, Whoopi Goldberg, first Academy Award.
Yeah.
Color of Night looks pretty ugly. It really does. But it does, you know, they just feel like they're evocative of a certain type of movie. And when you say it looks like Serendipity, I feel like that is a decision. I feel like that is on purpose. I feel like this is all kind of on purpose. And again, you know, it's that John Waters aesthetic of everything looking like it was built on a Baltimore soundstage with non-union workers.
But I think John Waters aesthetic, I think that like you know a John Waters movie by looking at one frame of
you
one
do,
scene.
You do.
And you're like, that's a style. If I saw one frame of this movie, and again, I loved it for what it is, but I don't think I'd be like, oh, this is this filmmaker's movie. Like, this is like a Wes Anderson movie. You know what I mean?
I know.
I think you're right. I think the decisions were made. I think my thing is, we had this question at the top, was what stops a movie like this from having a cult following? And I think it's style, because the movie itself is fucking nuts. Like the log line is enough to make everybody go see it at outdoor movies every summer in LA. Like it just is. It's like, that's like what you go see, right? But when you watch it, you're like, oh, some of this visually, aesthetically is flat and too flat for what the crazy story that I don't understand of the movie is.
There are a few things. It's a good, go ahead, Phil.
Can I just, very one quick thing, just because you mentioned the like seeing it out on a summer movie screen, sort of what have you.
Yeah.
And this will surprise you not at all, Kenny. I tweeted about this last night and Jordan Cruciola replied, is this the first time you've seen it? As though I would have seen this film multiple times. Like Jordan Cruciola, who is notoriously, we love her. She's been
one of the great contrarians of all time.
Perhaps the greatest contrarian. There are no bad movies for Jordan Cruciola, as far as I'm concerned, other than like Atonement is basically the only one she's decided to hate on.
No. Jordan dislikes the canon and loves everything else. And I love her for it very much.
Yes. And by the way, she can, similar to Kenny, she can defend it. And more power to both of them. But she was immediately like, I guess there might be a subculture of some sort that is really into.
Well, there should be. So I think to Lindsay's point, fair. Because I kept meaning to come back to the Teen Witch point, which was the best point. If this movie does feel like an 80s movie. It feels like
it does.
Like Mannequin, right? Like
one of these, which I love.
Mannequin, Teen Witch, like this,
Mannequin 2 on the move.
Mannequin 2. These things are you know, we did Weekend at Bernie's, right? Weekend at Bernie's 1. And we loved Weekend at Bernie's, right?
If this film was released in the 80s, I think to your point, this movie might have been huge.
So there's, if this movie was released in 1989 as opposed to 1999, it would have gotten play on Showtime over and over and over again when people were watching Showtime. Now, the other reason I think it is not, and by the way, like the cult classics of the late 90s, for the most part,
are darker, I think.
Yeah, they're different. They are. Yeah.
Look at the teen movies that survived from the 90s. You know, you exclude Election because, you know, it's a different kind of film.
Jawbreaker, I think, falls into that category.
Jawbreaker is dark.
I was going to say, you know, like the top of mind ones. So She's All That. The 10 Things I Hate About You.
Sure.
I think about, oh, those are fun. Oh, I do love
but those.
I think
those are on like Disney, ABC Family. They're totally, like, played all the time.
Yeah. I think about like The Virgin Suicides, which to me, I think is like an excellent movie. And I've rewatched that movie, but that's like, wow, that's a dark. And that movie was a period piece. And then there was a lot of movies that were in the 90s that were set in the 70s. But that to me was like, ooh, the late 90s for teens are kind of doing something dark.
I mean, you could include Election, but you could also include Dick in that. You could also include Drop Dead Gorgeous. We've done a lot of movies. Yeah. With teen actors with teen actors in the teen world that, like, you know, I'm a Cheerleader has a really soft heart, but you know, it's dealing with some pretty fucked up shit.
Yeah, it's a gay conversion camp.
It's a love story at its center, but yes, and a lot of these are, but those are the cults. The movie we're talking about are the cult movies. There are also these movies that are kind of, you know, the forever movies, as She's All That and 10 Things I Hate About You and Never Been Kissed and all those films. And
Varsity
then
Blues.
Varsity Blues. And
I
then
don't want your life.
Then there are these films that, you know, we've done that, like, kind of don't exist. Like, correct. Sibley Resistible is definitely one of them. I would say the Melissa Joan Hart movie drives me crazy. Is that
Ashley Lyles?
We like it too, but you know, it is kind of lost.
It didn't make an impact. But I do think you're right that it's similar. Big it's, TV well, star that kind of
and there
element
are, there are a bunch of them, and there are also a bunch of these like big TV stars tried to make movies like Three to Tango, and that movie and it disappeared and all that shit. Okay. The other thing that I would say this movie could have benefited from, though, again, I might have liked it less, but it would have been more of a cult movie, is a funnier script. Like, we just did 17 Again, and 17 Again is almost the opposite of this, and that 17 Again is the most boring fucking film of all time. If it were not for
the performances,
a bunch of really, really great performances and
carrying it,
and some really funny, you know, some really funny secondary characters. Leslie Mann and Thomas Lennon are really funny, well-written characters, and my guess is the actors brought a lot to that. We don't have this in this movie. This movie is too David Mamet-ish to let characters go that far outside of it, too Lynchian to let their characters to have characters that don't conform to this weird ass world.
The dialogue is grounded. Like, it is strangely a grounded rom-com with a magical crab.
It's not that comedic. The funniest thing is when Sean Patrick Flannery starts to realize what's going on. It's like, what's happening?
I have to ask this question, and it is not, I'm not trolling here, but I got to ask this question, okay?
I'm not trolling either.
I know you're not.
I am. That's why I came. I'm just here to watch the world burn. I'm here to watch the world burn.
You're just
and
the
it's,
Joker.
And I'm like,
so here's the thing, Kenny, and it's one of the things that makes me stumble on perhaps your 30,000 feet theory on this film, which
25.
Is that 25. I think this film is consciously aware of the tropes and the genre that it is a part of, right? So it is engaging in those narrative ideas and then also choosing to not engage on certain things. So it becomes kind of neither fish nor fowl for me, right? Which is that you're watching the film being like, okay, so there are no magical rules to this movie, unlike a 17 again, where like there are sort of rules, but like it is what it is.
Well, we spent the whole podcast talking about that. Those rules make no sense. But
sure. Yeah. No, I know, but I'm just saying that they attempt to give us enough guardrails to be able to go along with the story. Sure.
There's none of that here.
This movie is, there's no guardrails to this movie, which can That's either be true. A good thing or a bad thing.
Love it.
No rules, just right. It's like Outback Steakhouse. No rules, just right. It's like whatever
which,
goes.
By the way,
we're good.
Sure. I mean, that sounds glorious. There's a freedom to that, which I think is great. So the lack of guardrails, but also there are guardrails because it is playing in a sandbox of tropes and romantic comedy genre. It creates this dissonance where you're just sort of like, well, what am I supposed to be invested in? Now, again, I get where you're coming from, Kenny, which is perhaps they don't want you to invest in really anything. And it's just chaos.
I think the term neither fish nor fowl. I think you can be surf and turf. Right. So
this is great.
I think
everything but the kitchen sink went into this film.
Are there any other? Yeah, exactly.
I think there's something to that notion. Like I think about, I mean, it's a weird comp, but I think about a movie that I totally love, just Scary Movie. Yeah. And Scary Movie is so crazy and funny and irreverent. And then like, kind of has a great twist ending. And like you kind of at the end, you're kind of like, whoa, what just happened? You were setting that up the whole time. That was amazing. So I do think I think like the quote unquote romance of this is not very successful, but the, you know, I'm not trying to say it is. And by the way, if you don't think they're aware of what they're doing, listen back to this, to the score. The score is ludicrous.
Insane.
I actually wrote down last night listening, I was like, is the score maudlin? Because there were moments where it's like, ding, ding, ding. The score was so morose and like the score that was playing as Sarah Michelle Gellar's crying to the clientele of 90-year-old grandparents who come for like the chicken paillard. I was, why is this such a morose score?
See, I want to just, that's worth just unpacking for a quick second here because
okay, hold on before we get on the score, because I don't want to lose the score. I just want to finish my thought, which was essentially, I do think that, you know, in terms of like guardrails, magic realism guardrails, I like them because I'm not the kind of person who can make a Lynchian film. But the people who can, it's, you know, the people who can basically say, you know, this Godard-ish idea of none of it matters. Like, we're making it all up as we go along anyway, aren't we? I think that is really liberating and exciting. And I think there is I know this sounds crazy, a weird little element of that to it. Okay.
I want to unpack the score for a quick second, because I do think it speaks to what you're talking about, Candy, because I genuinely feel, because I remember when we did the pilot for Sleepy Hollow, we watched the pilot without a score. And I'm sure you guys have watched episodes without score, right?
Totally. Yeah.
And you watch it and you're just like,
yeah,
okay, I think this is working. I'm not really sure. Then the score is there and you're like, I know how to feel now, right? Like it is just an undercurrent of just, it binds the whole thing together.
God, which is why one of my least favorite criticisms of a score is the score is telling me how to feel. Bro,
that's what it's supposed to do.
That's what it's supposed to do. I think.
Right.
I think,
but this movie, I'm like, how am I supposed to feel?
So that's a great point. And it's so funny that we all noticed the score, and I literally wrote the score down, which is something I didn't think I'd be doing, like watching this movie. And it's so about tone. And that I think goes back to what we were talking about of the style of the movie, of capturing what's on the page of this movie. The score was playing for a very different movie than this movie. That is style, right? That is
a choice. Yeah.
That's a choice. It's a choice they made, but it's like, give your composer, have him do a round of notes on this one. Let's make this a bit brighter. Let's tell the story. Let's tell a romance. Because I did feel confused. Like, am I depressed?
Almost every aspect of this movie is designed for cognitive dissonance. Like it just is. And I think there are so many examples of these like wild ass auteurs, you know, like using Star. I mean, like, it's like, it's like Asayas, you're always using Kristen Stewart. There is just something to like using these people, because now she's, you know, indie darling weirdo chick, but like before then she was,
I love her.
Everyone does. She's the best. Before that she was Bella, what's her name, from
Swan.
Bella Swan.
Like,
but before that she was indie darling is the thing. Like
before that, she was in Panic Room. She obviously that's her sensibility. But like, I'm just saying there is something cool when some like wild ass indie person finds their, you know, their movie star is willing to go on these journeys. Nicole Kidman with Lars von Trier.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that like Sarah Michelle Gellar and, you know, this dude are the next Mark Tarlov are the next great, you know,
duo
actor director duo, but like it is fun to ground it in the expectations of, you know, young beautiful starlet and then subvert and, you know, mess with the audience every step of the way.
I think that the, you know, the pairing that I think of musically, music to director, is Terrence Blanchard, and the work he does with Spike Lee is some, you know, Spike Lee's one of those guys who periodically I do find myself taken out of his films by his scores, because his scores can be very oppressive and very sort of like, you know, the mix, even at times you're just like, is this just like mixed really loud? Like and that's an intent thing, right? Like he's definitely going for it. So I think that harmony, no pun intended, of these two artists is really special and really interesting. There's obviously a lot of filmmakers that work consistently with composers for obvious reasons. This was just one of those, like the score just, I was like, you said it best, Kenny. Every part of this movie is throwing you off. And I think that's either an asset or not, right? Like, and I can understand the joy that a person, specifically Kenny Neibart, can get from that, genuinely, where you're just like, this movie is so fucking in your face, doing something so crazy. That's exciting. And more times than not, it's exciting for me too. Every now and then it's not. And for this, it's not. But I understand.
It did to me feel like it was not that it didn't know what it was, but maybe it was scared of what it was. And some of these things we're talking about were like, ooh, you know, is score something that's addressed last, right? It's like, maybe the score was pluckier. Maybe there was a brighter, maybe there was a different tone to this movie. Maybe the notes were such that are like, this is too crazy. This is too wacky. Like, we need to feel sad when she's talking about her dead mother. And it's like, maybe these things, but they, it really did shape the tone in a strange way.
You know what I said at the end, Phil? Because I most of my notes, like up to halfway point, are like, this is
this sucks. Bad. I hate this.
Like I said, like one point I said it's like DCOM quality, which is what I thought it was. And then and I said the cover of Every Little Thing is a Crime Against the Ears.
But oh, the soundtrack, like, it was just insane.
But now I'm like, it was like
brilliant.
I'm not a chef's kiss, right? Now I'm like, maybe they knew it was a bad cover, because it's a really bad cover.
It's a cheap cover. That's why I was asking I was asking about budget, because it's like, oh, how much money did you have for these? I think about this a lot with 80s movies. I do think this is a movie that's out of time. Now all I can think is like Date with an Angel. Like this movie would have been like big in the 80s. But I think about a movie like an 80s horror movie, which I'm obsessed with, Night of the Comet. And that movie, it goes back to a cover of Cyndi Lauper's Girls Just Want to Have Fun throughout the movie.
What's Night of the Comet?
Oh, Night of the Comet is this amazing zombie apocalypse movie.
I'm looking at this right now.
By the way, it's a beautiful movie. It's shot beautifully. It is zombie apocalypse. Two sisters, one's a cheerleader, one's like a badass motorcycle chick, and they're hiding out in a mall. It's one of my favorite.
Oh, Phil, you'd love this. Yeah, this sounds great. Yeah, I'm definitely gonna watch this. This also apparently influenced the creation of Buffy Summers, so there you go.
Absolutely. I see all of it. That movie was, you know, an 80s kind of B horror movie that I think does have actually a cult following. It's an amazing movie. They made it probably for $10. Every song in the movie is a cover of a song, just and smart. A really bad cover of a song, but it's popular music. It's like, girls just want to have fun, but a shitty cover. And it's like, oh, smart. You can get the energy of that amazing song, right. But you can pay someone $7 to do it. That's how I felt about this, was like, guys, you can't even like blow it all out for the police. It's like, it's like put like dedicate money to one good needle drop. One.
But what's crazy about it is this same year, Sheryl Crow had a cover of this song that was there. That is also
right for the taking.
That is so terrible. It's one of my least favorite songs ever made. The cover.
Mine is Picture with Sheryl Crow and Kid Rock.
Oh, that's a horrible song. I love Sheryl Crow. I love her too. She really is very bad what she does sometimes. You know, you can't deny that, you know.
She got some stinkers, but
she started as Michael Jackson's backup singer. Like, there's just something to like, there is a real, amazing. And I love her, but there's a real like, I'm not going to say no to shit. Like I worked my ass off for this. I'm just not going to say no. So, all right. Well, the thing about,
can I just say one quick thing here? There are lines in this movie that I found myself going, that's circling something that's potentially profound. And then like there's a line that Amanda says to Tom near the end of the film, because he panics and he thinks she's a witch or whatever. And as he's leaving, she says, a man's character is his destiny. I think that means something, but I don't really know what that means. Like I think to Kenny's point, this is emblematic of the film for me. Writers sat down and wrote that line thinking it meant something.
Oh my God. And they were like, oh, that's brilliant.
And they're like, this is profound. There's something here. And then you actually take a second to look under the hood and you're like, no, I don't really think that means anything. Mm-hmm. Like that just means like be a good person. But anyway,
I think profundity is always overrated. There's no such thing. The only profound line ever written was, what is death but love persevering?
Kenny,
everybody made fun of that, but that's a profound
Kenny,
line.
You know that there are lines that you love that mean something to you and have
guy. Every on. Little thing he does is magic. I love that.
Come
line.
On,
you, literally, that's
I see, so I want to say okay. this. I want to say this to you, Phil, because I at near the end of this, I said maybe even weirder and better than Freddy Got Fingered. So that's how much I love this film. I think it is on Freddy Got Fingered's wavelength.
I'll say this, this is someone who to her husband said every day says, Daddy, would you like some sausage?
Yeah, we love that movie.
We love it. I would rewatch Simply Irresistible before I would sit down to rewatch Freddy Got Fingered.
God, I love that you say that to your husband every day.
No, I was like,
I think still would too.
Daddy, do you want some sausage? It's fucking brilliant. But
my husband and I also have another saying which touches on your Sheryl Crow, our Sheryl Crow conversation, and also is how I feel about Sarah doing this movie and maybe Sean Patrick Flannery, since this is the same year that Boondock Saints came out. This is a big year for these actors. Mm-hmm. This is a huge year for them. My husband and I have this saying, whenever we watch a movie or see a TV show where we think someone who's sort of out of the league of the material is doing it, mm-hmm. we're like, why are they doing it? And we just go, bitches gotta work, I guess. And it's like, you know what? Bitches gotta work.
People
like,
gotta eat. People yeah, gotta I mean, work. They got bills to pay. I know for sure. I Freddy Got Fingered.
Make the best of it.
Here, I mean, I Freddy Got Fingered, which we spoke on Screen Drafts we spoke about it a lot. I think that Freddy Got Fingered is overtly doing something. I think that this movie
is covertly doing something.
Covertly doing something.
Perhaps covertly doing something. Whereas I think that Freddy Got Fingered is, I mean, that is an art piece of an order that I don't think I've ever seen, or maybe never will see again, of just someone who truly got a fucking big check from a studio and was like, I'm just going to do this. I'm going to milk a cow with my mouth. You know, it's just, I'm going to do these things. this movie obviously is not going to the same extent. This movie is obviously a sweeter movie. This movie is just a kinder movie. I think
Freddy Got Fingered is obviously a masterpiece. I don't mean to knock it in any way. It is superior to this film, but Freddy Got Fingered is doing a very similar thing to this film, which is, you know, take a very popular genre, like at that point, the, you know, kind of the gross out bro-ish comedy, and take it to its extremity and put all the people who like that kind of shit in a really uncomfortable position. I think this is doing something similar with the rom-com. I think this is a weird ass movie where someone let his freak flag fly and nobody appreciated it. And that's really all it comes down to for me.
I'll say this. I have seen dozens of movies like Freddy Got Fingered. Yep. I see one every 10 years when the Jackass guys get together and I go to the theaters every time. I've seen dozens of bro-y, gross, like I can do whatever the fuck I want, carte blanche movies. I think they're funny. I show up for them. I've never seen a movie like Simply Irresistible, and I don't think I ever will. I don't think a movie like this will ever be made again. When I, you know, when I finished watching the movie last night, my husband was like, "You want me to watch with you?" And I was like, "No, don't worry about it. Like, go play a video game with your brother." I normally do this thing where if I see movies without John, I'm so excited to tell him about them, and like I'm going crazy. And there was like a weekend once where I stayed home and I'd never seen any of the Twilight movies, and John went away and he came home and I was like, "John, I have to tell you all about these crazy movies." I walked out of the room having watched Simply Irresistible, and John was like, "Well," and I was like,
I don't even know.
No, yeah. I was like, I
hope where, you know now.
Where to begin? Like, I could give you the log line, but I don't think it would do it justice, and I don't think you'd believe me.
I'm gonna say one more thing to piss off anybody else who doesn't hate me right now.
Okay.
Three words: live action Miyazaki.
That's insane. I will say this though. I do think
it is a Miyazaki premise. Think about it. The girl who could bake her feelings into her food.
I love that crab who
hangs out.
I do think there's a version of this movie which would take away the specialness of and the craziness, which but would make this movie more popular, where Sarah Michelle Gellar's an actual witch who bakes her feelings into her food. I feel like, though not a witch, that I love that premise, and that sort of idea I think was captured so beautifully and amazingly in the late great Adrienne Shelley's Waitress film, beautiful movie. Mm-hmm. That is less the consumers feeling the feelings, but more the like the chef and the baker working her feelings out, I think, in a beautiful stylistic way. And just to bring up Waitress is a stylish movie. The diner is stylish. There's like an arc for the look of the diner. The end of the movie, everything's in color and beautiful. The pies are stylistic. Just to bring up one, sorry, Kenny, to neg Simply 1999 Simply Irresistible. I want to bring up one thing that bummed me out about the movie. The one thing that bummed me out. And a movie.
Only one.
This was the one in a perfect film. There was one thing that bummed me out. And a movie all about food and restaurants and cooking, the food styling and the food looked they were terrible. Eating looked fucking disgusting. When I go see a movie about food, like when I went to see Chef, it was like porn every time they pulled something out of
Chef
the oven.
Did a great job in that.
It was like the food was like amazing. The food in this looked so disgusting. I was like, ugh, crab Napoleon. If I have to look at any fucking cold dead prop crab anymore.
I think she made that up.
By the way, even the eclairs. It's not, I Googled it. It's real. I was like, am I so not refined that I don't know what crab Napoleon? It's like the only crab obviously I have never told, like the last time I had crab, it was endless at Red Lobster. So I'm not like a refined.
It was in a California roll.
A thousand percent. The food looked terrible. In a movie about food, make the food look beautiful. And
you're also tapping into something. Part of the one of the Mark Tarlov quotes, he talks about how food and wine actually bends time and space, right? And this idea, and by the way, there have been many movies about food. I couldn't help but think of Big Night or Ratatouille watching this film.
Crabatouille.
And thinking about sort of Crabatouille. You know, this movie's definitely trying to play in that, you know, in that milieu. But to your point, the food was so unappealing to look at that it kind of hindered some of that.
It hindered, and this is such a simple, guys, this is such a simple storytelling thing to do. but something so simple and visual is show a plate of food that Sarah Michelle Gellar makes at the beginning of the movie. That's that's like every plate we saw in the movie. Mm-hmm. By the end of the movie, show the food that's amazing. And even when we get to the department store 4-star restaurant, there's nothing I want to eat on that plate. Everything looked disgusting.
Well, this makes me think of one of my favorite lines in this movie, because it's insane, is that at the beginning of the film, when Amanda hears that her family's restaurant is closing, she says, "But we've been here for 70 years.
Doing what?
Yeah, that restaurant has been there for 70 years.
I'm taking, that's hilarious. Style. I'm taking back to
since the 20s. Really? Since it's Art Deco. Restaurant Art Deco.
They opened it in the middle of
the Great Depression.
We were fucking killing it in the 40s.
I know. They're like those poor restaurants that opened the day before the fucking lockdown. Point about the witch is an interesting one, because I think that if she were an actual witch,
that's true.
This movie would be...
It would make sense.
It would be less interesting, probably.
Significantly less interesting, way more beloved. More of an obvious cult movie candidate type thing.
Yeah, Sarah Michelle Gellar plays a witch chef. That would be a thing. Yeah.
That would be a thing, and that would make sense, and you could still have silly fun with it. The other thing you guys are talking about with the food looking bad, I don't know if I thought it looked that bad, but I hear you guys. I wonder also, if this was John Waters...
It'd be repulsive.
It would be repulsive.
But that would be stylish. and that's the choice.
Again, this will probably get clipped too, but maybe John Waters is a little too obvious, guys. Maybe he's a little too out there on friends.
You're now using Simply Irresistible to go back.
The good version of John Waters.
Make artistry away from John Waters.
It wouldn't be the first time I've done something like this before. I'm like, I regret it to this day. We did Ghost Dog, and I'm God. Who's Ghost Dog again? I'm losing
it's Jim Jarmusch.
So I'm like, Jim Jarmusch really makes Quentin Tarantino look like he just is so obvious. And everyone jumped down my throat, appropriately so. That's not really what I should be doing here. But what I am doing is saying I think Tarloff has his own unique voice that's important in the American landscape, the cultural landscape. I think that frankly, we're lucky we only got one movie from him. Maybe I would have been proven wrong on movie two, which, by the way, he did make movie two. It just never got released.
I was going to ask that question. I was going to ask, is this that thing where it's the small movie that then the director goes on to make this huge, successful movie? I guess
it's his Rent. Yeah.
Yeah. This is your rent.
Yeah.
Oh, his Jonathan Larson Rent?
Yeah.
You know what's funny? I've been circling the directing only one movies draft for Screen Drafts. And how cool would it be if I drafted this film?
would love to attach myself to remake Simply Irresistible if we could all do it together.
Do you know what the original title for Simply Irresistible was? Called Vanilla Fog.
Okay.
Oh, that's good.
Great. two things about that, Phil, if I may.
Please.
One, I almost began with guys, I thought we were talking about the Robert Palmer hit Simply Irresistible. I came very prepared to talk about that.
And
for
just
an
got
hour.
Notes, 10 pages of notes on Simply Irresistible.
By the way, if you're going to name at that time, if you're going to name a movie a popular song, which, mind you, the song was from the 80s, when the movie should have been. I want to hear a poor cover of that fucking song.
Yeah, why wasn't there?
You can't name it Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic. Too wordy. I hear you. But when you name a 90s rom-com film after a song that everyone knows, where is it?
Yeah, Addicted to Love has Addicted to Love in it.
Addicted to Love, Potion Number 9. You hear that song the whole fucking movie. Again, 80s. Don't name a movie after a song that everyone knows and loves and never play it. I was waiting. I was like, where's my cover of Addicted to Love? Where is she? And it never came.
Never happened.
All right. So I actually will give another data point for
my score's going down.
Another data point for my my argument that this boy is brilliant, Mark Tarlov. His other movie, which was never theatrically released or even released on video, it was shown once at the New York Musical Film Festival. Excuse me, the New York Musical Festival. Mm-hmm. It's called Temptation. It stars Adam Pascal and Zoe Saldana. Yeah, and Anika and Anika Noni Rose. You got a real cast for this. The story tells the tale of Faust making a deal with the devil in rock musical form. Come on, guys.
Honestly, I would kill to see
this guy's all right.
I would kill to see a rock musical of Faust
with Adam Pascal.
That's true. I believe, by the way, Angelinos, I believe Adam, Pretty Woman, the musical, I think, is playing in
LA. It's true.
And I was like, dare I? And then I heard Adam Pascal's in it, and it's like, I'm getting tickets. So
he's playing Richard Gere?
I think so. And look, you're talking to someone who went to see Ghost, the musical at Pantages. So it's not.
What was that?
It wasn't great. But you know what was great? Let's talk about style for a second. Let's talk about 2013's Ghost, the musical at Pantages. As far as style goes, I thought the production design, you know, the scene, and I love the movie Ghost. I would love to talk about it with you.
Yeah, great movie.
Amazing movie. So you know the scene when like Tony Goldwyn's losing his fucking mind and like the demons drag him away?
Yes, of
looked
course.
Amazing. The shadows on stage were incredible.
Oh, wow.
Also the scene where he goes to the office in the movie and Patrick Swayze's like haunting him and shit's typing and everything's going crazy. Looked incredible. I was like, how are they doing it? How are they pulling this off? The keys are typing themselves. Like there are demons everywhere. Would love to go back and see Ghost the Musical. Not great, but would do it again.
Yeah.
That sounds pretty good. I assume they, you know, they sing Unchained Melody.
And they get weird. And it's like, because it's a musical, he like plays the guitar, but you really just want them covered in clay. So
yeah. They don't do the bass.
They do the thing, but he had to like sing the song to her. It's a whole thing. Yeah. Maybe they've since workshopped it.
It's probably, are they original songs? Are they jukebox musical?
No, it was like jukebox. I think my memory of it was jukebox musical. Yeah.
You know, look.
I'll tell you one thing.
Life is too short to spend $80 for a jukebox musical.
Look, at that time. Broadway,
but, you know. It's true.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. Pretty Woman plays the song Pretty Woman. So
Pretty Woman is a great soundtrack.
It's an amazing.
It must have been Love, but it's over now. I mean, Roxette. Yes. Roxette, there you go.
Amazing.
We're
having more fun talk about other movies, which is
this was unfortunately Gene Siskel's last film that he reviewed before his death.
Unfortunately,
he gave the film a thumbs down. For what that's worth, Sarah Michelle Gellar has stated that this is one of her least favorite films she's been in.
I believe that.
You know, I think that. Listen, Kenny's words have not rung. Have not fallen on deaf ears.
I can tell.
I
can tell.
No, don't be too cocky. You move that much. Should we rate this? Kenny, I'm going to ask you to go first on this rating.
Sure, I'll rate it first. Never saw this, obviously. Why would anyone watch this movie before this podcast existed?
Sure.
Look, I actually only gave this a 61 after the first viewing. I thought that this was, you know, there's a lot of bad mixed in with the good. Now, after this discussion, I think there's almost no bad mixed in with the good. I think it's a great movie, a vital piece of American filmmaking. I'm going to go all, I will admit it's not the most joyous and enjoyable watch. I do think most people would be like, Kenny, you're crazy. So I'm going to go only marginally higher to a 79. Simply as Istanbul is getting a 79 from me.
Anyone
want to go next?
Lindsay?
That's insane. Well, I will say that what I thought, I had the expectation going into watching the movie last night, expecting to not like it.
Well, what did you think when you saw it when in 99 because you saw it around then, right?
I saw it then. Yeah. I think, I mean, I loved Sarah Michelle Gellar and still do, sure. But I think it was that thing that was like, well, that was a movie. And I lived at the movie theater. That's like where I just lived at the movie theater. And 99 was obviously the best year to live in the theater.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
But at the time, it was a forgettable movie for me. Like, especially once Cruel Intentions came out the next month, nobody's talking about Sarah Michelle Gellar and Simply Irresistible. Like, that.
We're talking about her kissing Selma Blair in a park.
Absolutely. And like, park, yeah. being a badass fucking evil bitch. Like, she was so amazing in it.
Amazing.
And that, what those were the movies, and like Girl Interrupted were the movies. Mm-hmm. That was my 99 coming of age movie. So Simply Irresistible was a forgettable movie to me at the time. And I think because I was a teenager, I thought I was way too cool for that movie, right?
Sure.
Watching, so I went into last night thinking that I was going to give it, I got influenced by Rotten Tomatoes. And I was like, this is going to be a 20. Like, this is going to be a 20. I will say last night when I finished it, I was like, this is a 60. This is a 60 for me. After our conversation, guys, Phil, you've made some valid points and I have rethought everything and questioned some things. I truly believe it lives and deserves a solid 50. I don't think it is like solid in the sense that like there are movies where I would say never watch this movie. I would say you should watch this movie because you won't believe what you're going to see. But I don't know that I can in good conscience give it more than 50.
It's the it's the existence 50. That's what we call it on this podcast.
I think that's right. It's like a solid down the middle, like
a strong reverence for the film, but also knowing that maybe it's not something that everyone's going to love.
And do you know what it is? For me, truly for me, the thing that made me question lose the 10 points, it is the style. It's like not pushing the boundary, not going there with the design, with the score, with the look of everything, like not embracing what the movie is. Like it felt like there was a sense of like, maybe we don't want to be in this movie and don't want to be making this movie. I just wanted it to be as crazy as the story is.
Yeah, I mean...
What do you got, Phil?
I genuinely, here's the thing. I went into this with no expectations, really. I expected this to be a Lindsay Lohan-esque rom-com, something along those lines, whatever that Chris Pine one was.
Those bad ones, like Lucky
You. I really did not, but I will say this. I had a hint back when I was on Station 19, there was a writer on that show because I would often talk about the movies that we were going to cover. He's like, wait, Simply Irresistible, is that the one with the crab? And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. So like, again, I had an inkling there was a crab. So that was really all I was going into this movie with. I pressed play and that first opening scene, I was like, oh, this is going to be a long watch.
Agreed.
I came into this podcast at a 25. I think that it's, and both of you have made some very solid arguments about why it's worth more than that. So I I'm up to 42. That's as high as I'm going to go with this movie. I don't think that this movie's good. I don't think this movie should be watched. I don't think anyone should watch this movie.
I disagree with that.
I don't think it should be watched.
I think that it's, that being said, you know, Kenny, you made some valid arguments in terms of whether or not
appraisal.
I don't think this movie should be reappraised.
It definitely should. By modern audiences, people should give it a shot. I guess what you're saying is don't even bother. What I'm saying is I would like to hear, like, I'd like to hear 20 of our best friends.
I would gladly
see what they think.
Bring on 20 people to talk about this film and create a panel. But I think that
I didn't do this on purpose because I have fucking no idea what this movie was.
No,
I knew that Lindsay would be into it. I mean, as into it as she ultimately was. But I knew that like Lindsay, like every October, Lindsay watches 31 of the worst fucking horror movies you've ever heard of.
Or the best. Just, I like to do, if I have time, I do have a love for watching a horror movie a day. And when you get into 31 of them, and when you're a horror fan, it's like, let's start watching the movies I've never seen. And that's right. When you start getting to like the true dregs of like, oh shit.
Well, so here's a question for you. Next week, I wonder if you've seen the films that we're covering next week, which are we're doing From Dusk Till Dawn 2 and 3, which both came out in 1999. Have you seen these films?
I've seen From Dusk Till Dawn 2. I've not seen 3.
Did you enjoy 2? I mean, obviously not, or you would have watched 3, I'm assuming.
I don't think so. I think that was like a Blockbuster pickup for me kind of thing at the time. Sure. You know, was that direct to video?
Both of them were direct to video.
Yes.
It's so rare that you get two sequels that come out within a 12-month span. So yeah. I was kind of like, we gotta do this.
Very Matrixy.
I have complicated. I do like From Dusk Till Dawn, though. I have complicated feelings about it, and Quentin Tarantino. Sure. And guys, I fucking hate him. And it's like, I can't watch you suck on somebody's toes for 1 second. It's like, did you really need to write yourself in as the pedophile who sucks on toes? Congratulations. We see.
Yeah, I have very conflicted feelings about From Dusk Till Dawn as well. It's exactly what you're speaking of. But I do like that it's kind of two movies. Like it's this weird.
I can't believe I'm about to watch 6 hours of From Dusk Till Dawn.
It's insane. That's insane.
I think they're both like 90 minutes.
The sequel was something I did pick up. It was like direct to video, watch it. In the same ways that I've seen like the sequels to The Lost Boys, those like direct to video.
Right.
But I'm never going to be like, oh yeah, you got to run out and see like The Lost Boys, The Tribe. Like
So we don't need to talk about Tarantino because that's a whole thing, but I'm curious as to like where you fall on the Grindhouse thing, right? Like, because I do think that this is a whole oeuvre in itself, right? Of people that are into, I say this with absolutely no judgment, this kind of seeing every kind of subpar, low budget horror movie that's ever been made. I know that, Kenny, you've seen a lot of horror movies, but I don't know that you're into this particular lane.
I wish I were. It's not that I'm not into it. It's just that I haven't gone there. If I ever can go there, I will go there.
Totally. I agree. Look, I think some of those movies can be cool as shit, meaning I love the aesthetic of those movies. Right. I love kind of the gore in those movies. I do tend to shy away from anything that gets to be too like torture porny with my horror. Right. I don't like it.
Eli Roth of it all.
I'm not a fan. In fact, I was so mad. Shark Week is my favorite week of the year. And a couple weeks back, it was like Eli Roth hosting Shark Week. And it's like, why? It's like, now I can't even watch the fucking sharks I love because your mug is over here fucking like talking about sharks. Like, I don't need
the sharks I love.
You ruined sharks.
Ruined Shark Week for me. Like Green Inferno, I'm not interested. Like I that's just not my genre. And I say this to gentlemen here, but I feel like there's like, I mean, horror is this a lot and can be, but I think there's an element, especially of like 90s grindhousey horror and 2000s grindhousey horror, that is the most toxic masculine version of horror that almost circles back to the 70s, where it's like, we want to be Wes Craven when he made rape movies. Like, that's who we want to be because we can get away with it. And I kind of hate that.
It feels like that's more of a early 2000s thing to me at least, than a 90s thing.
Late 90s, early 2000s. Yeah. Like 2001.
Yeah. And I think they don't necessarily realize that like Wes Craven was like the only one who was worth having a career out of the hundreds of thousands of people who made movies like that in the 70s.
Yeah.
You know? I don't mean he was the only one. That's too glib. But like,
I mean, Sam Raimi, right? Like Sam, like Evil Dead. Amazing. Yeah,
like Roger. People talk about the Roger Corman people, but it's not as if it was just fucking Brian De Palma and Martin Scorsese. There were hundreds of people who made movies for him. Those were just the guys who were really good.
I also just think that, you know, and not to get on a, you know, not to go down this whole rabbit hole necessarily, but there's just not. There's not enough female horror directors on top of all of this, right? We're seeing more of them. You know, you do have your Karan Kusamas, you have your Anna Lily Amanpour, Leah Janik, who I think is awesome.
Yeah.
She's doing some really cool shit.
Nia DaCosta.
Nina DaCosta, or I mean, I don't think that. I mean, does Julia and I don't know how to the director of Titan. Is that
body
that's
horror.
Really horror? But all this is to say that it. What's interesting is that it feels like there's just a lot more thought being put into these particular films, right? And part of it, I imagine, is because it's hard to get these films made. Shouldn't be, but it is. It's hard for a woman to get these films made. It's hard for women to get films made, period. So I feel like their stuff has to be elevated.
Totally.
Whereas men are allowed to make grimy, shitty mistakes and whatever. So it's, which obviously is unfortunate, but I do think that it means that their stuff's really fucking good. So like, you know,
I also think horror fans like now are really well educated, well read film people. Yeah. And they're also it's a pretty progressive lot at this point. Mm-hmm. So I do think like the horror that has survived over the last, you know, 100 years, but last 50 years tends to be stuff that at least is engaging with bigger ideas in terms of identity, in terms of, you know, vulnerability and that kind of stuff. And I think that's the stuff that really kind of birthed the modern horror fan for the
most. Well, I think Jordan Peele, you know, Jordan Peele degree is part of that.
Yeah. Too, of course, but
he's making it more of like a popcorn experience. He's like opening it up to wider audiences, I think, than has been.
Not making it seem as though it has to stay in one lane either. Like his stuff, like there's a lot of comedy, obviously, in his stuff too.
Yeah,
his shit's wonderful. But even the smaller stuff in general, it's just not as exploitative as it seemed 20 years ago.
Agree.
It's true for a lot of subcultures right now. Just a lot of subcultures seem to be peopled by, or, you know, the fans, just by just more progressive people who are just are looking for different kinds of stories.
I think it's, you know, Kenny and I, obviously we've been doing this podcast for a while and, you know, have split ourselves into sort of three different years. And I think it's really fascinating to look at what horror was in 89, what horror was in 99, and what horror is in 2009. They're all very different. And I think that horror, perhaps maybe more so than any other genre, gets a lot of cracks because it's relatively cheap.
Yeah.
And it can be really, really lucrative. So, you know, the studios are always going to go back to the well on horror. And I think it generally is a mirror to what we're living through in the moment. Right. And I think that, you know, you look at, you know, your Freddy Krueger's, your Jason's, your what have you's in the 80s. And then in the 90s, you know, Kenny and I have talked about how kind of a weird year for horror. You know, you have End of Days, you have Audition, which I guess might be considered a horror movie. In 99,
but not an American horror movie, so it's hard to place it within this conversation.
No, absolutely. But you know, the studio horror films are Stigmata and End of Days, which are pretty soft horror films, if you'd even really call
and
them
the Haunting films. It sucks.
Sure.
They suck. Or Hill House, whatever.
But there's a great indie horror film this year, Blair Witch.
Yes,
which
exactly.
Changed everything.
Which then in 2009 you get Paranormal Activity, which is Blair Witch. You know,
totally.
20 years later, it's really interesting. I think it's a really malleable, fascinating genre that I didn't watch for many, many years because I'm a big baby and I've been trying to watch more of it.
Not anymore, Phil.
I appreciate that.
You're a
grown up. I'm a big boy now.
You're a grown up. There is one horror movie that I do think kind of changed the landscape in 99 too, that this is a person to have a conversation about as well, but The Sixth Sense. As far as horror movies being wildly successful, who at the time, I don't think, showed up to horror movies or weren't horror fans, they were talking about The Sixth Sense. It helped that Bruce Willis was the star and was a huge movie star, but it also was a great movie with a great fucking twist, and you're invested in the characters and you love the little boy and Tony Collette, and like I still do think that is a brilliant movie.
I agree. You know, Kenny and I did that. Jesus, I don't even remember when we did it. It was certainly, I think, like 3 years ago now. But and I remember, you know, we had a whole conversation about it, and I think that M. Night Shyamalan's career is fascinating in what it's done, sort of the ups and downs that he's
had. It was definitely before Old, definitely before Old.
Came.
Might have even been before Split or right around.
It was before Split.
Split,
Split. I mean, it was post.
Split gave him
the
like
Visit.
Yeah.
So like, there was these little, you know, hints that he was coming back. Like when the Visit happens, you're kind of like, right, there might be a lane back.
No, I think old is fucking great.
He's a different guy now than he was when we did 100%. This movie. But yeah, no, Sixth Sense is a really good, really good call in terms of it had a lot. And to me, Get Out is more of a Sixth Sense.
1,000%. 100%.
You know,
100%. That tone. Yeah. Or even like, I think this was 99. You guys will have to fact check me, but Stir of Echoes is one that comes.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Stir of Echoes, I think, is a brilliant movie. It shares.
I like Stir of Echoes.
It's like,
you're okay with it.
It's like, I really like, I love Stir of Echoes. One, I think I love that genre of a paranormal horror story.
Sure.
I love being haunted. I remember like having not seen that movie maybe since it's come out. There are moments that I remember that stayed with me. Like I remember the flash of the girl dragging along the ground and her fingernail popping off. Like there are moments of visceral horror that stayed with me from that movie. I remember the soundtrack. I remember Paint It Black playing. There are moments that are iconic in that movie that stay with you 20 years later, which I think does make like a good
I think that movie, I mean, I think David Capp is an underrated filmmaker, quite honestly. I think that he's done a lot of really fun stuff. And I think that on top of being, you know, obviously a very successful screenwriter, there's some really arresting images in Stir of Echoes that still stay with me. That empty movie theater. There's a bunch of stuff that there's some really interesting. I mean, we did a whole episode on it. And I think to Kenny's point, we kind of all came out on it being like, this is a above average. This is better than I expected it to be. It got swallowed by Sixth Sense, which came out, I believe, like 2 weeks before it did.
And they shared DNA.
And just sort of blew it out of the water. And they shared DNA. So it was just sort of, but this is all to say, like, I don't know. I'm curious to see, first of all, I'm curious to watch these From Dusk Till Dawn movies, but also just, you know, we've got a couple horror movies in 09 we're going to cover on our Patreon as well, which I'm excited to cover. But yeah, I'm excited to see where horror goes now. I do think that Jordan Peele is sort of at the forefront of that. And I'm curious. I think that the Candyman reboot, which he obviously was a producer on, I'm curious to see sort of how they get people. And I know you guys probably haven't seen this trailer yet because it dropped literally this morning. But there's a trailer for this movie called Smile, which Paramount is releasing on the last week of September. So it's sort of their early Halloween movie. I don't know what the fuck it's about, but like, it's a good trailer. It's a creepy trailer. It's just people smiling.
I've seen something.
There's like a teaser that was playing in theaters. Now there's a full trailer.
Yes. Yes.
I bring this up also because it's starring Kevin Bacon's daughter. The Stir of Echoes connection is there, but it actually looks genuinely creepy. And I'm like, you know what, these movies, they're evergreen. We're never,
totally. I think, it's fun. I thought you were going to say Black Phone. I feel like I've seen that Black poster.
That poster's been,
everywhere.
For like a year.
10 years. But I also don't think I've ever seen a trailer. It's like, are you going to drop it? Is there
pretty
a
trailer? Scary.
But I think that was a holdover. That was a COVID thing, right? Like they shot it and I'm assuming that was
maybe that, perfectly blame COVID for anything right now, which is great. I think the thing that Jordan Peele's bringing, which is amazing, is I don't know, and I don't want to say this isn't the case of a lot of horror movies, but Jordan Peele brings a lot of substance and social commentary to his horror films. And he makes them dramas and he makes them character dramas. And that has to be really exciting to a Catherine Keener. That has to be really exciting to elevated actors. And I think when you have, and also he's just an amazing director. Like I feel like people don't talk about Us as much. Us was a movie that when I watched it in theaters, I didn't like it. And I was like, it got too big. Okay. Like the amazing thing about Get Out is it's small. It's the one house. It's the family. It's these people. Us were literally across the world. It was crazy. I had to reevaluate because I love him so much and rewatched and it stayed with me. I really love it. And I think just as a director, even just as a director, thinking about his style, thinking the way he shoots movies, thinking about how the teaser of that movie, which is beautiful, that you're staying with a little girl and you're in her POV. It's all about her. It's like a simple choice, but a brilliant choice that's not made often. So I think having an elevated director who shoots movies beautifully, who casts incredible actors, who casts someone like Lupita Nyong'o to star in a horror movie.
How she didn't get an Oscar nomination for that performance.
I think she deserved it. We actually talk, not shameless plug, but our show, mine and Roberto Aguirre Sacasa, who of course everyone knows who he is, Roberto, who is an amazing person, and I'm very lucky to be making something with him. We both love horror, and we connected over that. And so for our kind of take on this, we're like, this is a horror show, it's a slasher show, but it's still about five young women. So right. It needs to be, we need to ground this in like real societal horror. We need to ground this in stories about sexual assault. We need to ground this in stories about grooming, and yet still have a slasher villain. And we were very inspired by Jordan Peele in the movie. In one of the episodes, the girls are like setting up a double feature of Get Out and Us. Like we love him. So, but it is so nice to see like a horror film get nominated for an Academy Award, that for writing.
Won an Academy
and win.
Win an Academy Award for the script, and deservedly so. It was an amazing script. So that excites me. I love that horror can be elevated. I'm still going to show up to something like Ready or Not, and I had a blast with that.
Love Ready or Not.
Great flip.
Great movie. That's not winning any Oscars, but I had the time of my life. It was simple. I love the setup. Like it was batshit. So I kind of love that. I do feel like horror is like shifting and changing, but
it's why
really
I was that much
a really
more...
good time.
Well, yeah. Ready or Not is unfortunate. I think Kenny and I, we talked about this, but like I really liked Ready or Not.
Me too.
And I had really high expectations for their Scream reboot because it was the same filmmakers. And I didn't really love the Scream reboot that much. I didn't hate it, but I wanted it to be
I really
more.
Liked watching it, but it I feel fun. The same way. Yeah, I feel the same way as you do ultimately. It's no Scream 4.
It's no Scream 4.
What is?
Well, Lindsay,
it's no Scream 2.
Thank you so much for coming on to talk about magical crabs with us. The animal, not the STD. but it's this was a blast. We obviously had an amazing time. When is your show going to be premiering, and how can people see it?
We are premiering July 28th, so end of next month, and we'll be streaming on HBO Max, which is really, really, really awesome. Exciting. So please tune in and don't send me your hate mail.
Keep the hate mail, just watch the show.
And what's your Twitter handle? Just kidding.
Oh, guys, I know.
Just
you know
kidding.
I'm not on
don't,
it.
Don't
know
do
I'm not
it.
On it.
Oh, my God. Good for you.
I'm not on it. You know what? And I do question. I don't know if you guys feel this way. But yeah, I'm like, ooh, is it time to like get on? But now it's like, I don't want that.
No. If you're off, stay off. And I also, especially with your, you don't need a tidal wave of people telling you what they think about your show. It's you're better off for it. But more than anything, thank you so much for coming on. This was a blast. We'd love to have you back. We can't wait to talk about something else with you in the future.
I had so much fun. This was amazing. And what a great excuse to watch Simply Irresistible on a Tuesday.
thank you so much, Lindsay.
It's
great talking
to you.
Bye.
Good to talk to you.
See you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Kenny. Nice to meet you. Bye, guys.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.